The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dan Pink. Dan Pink is the best-selling author of such books as A Whole New Mind, Drive, and To Sell Is Human. He can be read frequently in such publications as the New York Times, Fast Company, Wired, and the Harvard Business Review. In a former life, he was an aide to then-Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, and he was a speechwriter for Al Gore when Gore was Vice President of the United States. Most importantly, though, he is a graduate of Northwestern University. Go Wildcats! Dan Pink, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thank you very much, Kelly. It's good to be here.
I am an unabashed fan of your work for many reasons.
Why, thank you.
And I want to talk about some of the great stories and ideas from your books, but I want to actually start with a commencement speech that you recently delivered at Georgetown University. So you led the graduating class through an experiment. You had them raise their dominant hand, snap five times with that hand, and then draw an E on their forehead. Can you walk us through the rest?
Yeah, sure. So I decided this is a technique that social psychologists have used for about the last 30 years to measure perspective taking, to measure the ability of human beings to see things from other people's points of view. And what this measures is, once you do this, is that it really measures. You don't know what if you're the participant in this experiment, you don't know what's being measured. Mm-hmm. And so this assesses what's your default, what's your go-to move. Is your instinct, not knowing the circumstances, to take someone else's perspective or take your own perspective? And, you know, this concept of perspective taking, where there's a rich body of research in social psychology on this, I think ends up being extraordinarily important in so many realms of life. And one of the things that I was telling these Georgetown students, because I have become the old man who gives wisdom to young people, is the research showing this, how much power feeling a sense of power can distort your perspective taking abilities,
right?
And that's how a lot of people go awry. Their sense of power, their sense of achievement, their rising through the ranks, say, of an organization, ends up having a negative effect on their ability to take the other's perspective. And the consequence of that is they become less effective in whatever they're doing.
Right. So in improvisation, we actually talk about the need to be others focused. And so many of those beginning improv exercises contain a point of focus outside of the individual, because we understand that most human beings are primarily self-conscious creatures.
I agree with that completely. Like, one of the, I did sort of a modest amount of, I wrote about this in another book, some amount of improv of training. And in one of the exercises that I thought was quite interesting was one where, I can't think of the name of it, but where you're having a conversation with somebody about, say, a contentious issue.
Right.
And you're only allowed to ask questions. You're not allowed to say, that's interesting. What about bobbity bobbity bop? You're not allowed to say you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's interesting, because one of the other things that I mentioned in that speech, which is an idea that comes from, really has its roots in another very famous social psychologist at Michigan, and being a native of Columbus, Ohio, when I say the University of Michigan, I have to go
yeah,
Bucks.
You have to take them off.
A guy named Carl Icahn, and what he says is that it's a great line. It's fight like you're right, listen like you're wrong.
I love that.
Fight like you're right. Yeah, and I think that's actually very much in sync with a lot of the notions of improv, because so much of it is about being a good listener.
Yeah, and those beginning classes are essentially unlearning classes, right? Because we're so conditioned to have those defaults that you really have to get people practice in, you know, because they won't believe it. You could say it to them, like, no, I'm taking the other person's perspective. But then when you actually model it, like we have one of those exercises where you have to listen to the last word of the sentence that the person says, and then you have to say that word, and it throws off the entire rhythm of the conversation because most of us have stopped listening halfway through, you know, what everyone's talking about.
So I want to talk
to you a little bit about your book, To Sell as Human. You talk about the ABC of selling, and you identify those as attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. So in the parlance of improvisation, we might use the words empathy, resilience, and yes and, but that would make for like a really bad acronym. What makes up those qualities when you talk about attunement, buoyancy, and clarity?
Well, attunement is really perspective taking. It's basically getting out of your own head and seeing things from someone else's point of view. And just to back up a second, these are the what social science says are the main attributes in being an effective persuader in a world, and this is a big deal here, in a world where information is, there's parity of information, P-A-R-I-T-Y, parity of information. It used to be that there was information asymmetry, that is, sellers of anything had more information than the buyer. Now it's parity. And so if you look at the research, it's attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. Attunement is perspective taking. Buoyancy is an interesting one. It's basically, you know, you get rejected all the time if you're trying to persuade, sell, influence.
Right.
And so buoyancy is what can you do to stay afloat in this ocean of rejection that you're in?
Yep.
And clarity is how do you go from accessing information to curating it? That is, it used to be you had an edge if you had access to information. Now everybody has it, so it's really a sense-making function. How do you distinguish the signal from the noise in this rich body of information? And then also going from, this is an interesting thing, I think, in improv and even broaderly creative terms, is how do you go from being a good problem solver to being a good problem finder? Yeah. How do you identify hidden problems? How do you identify, how do you look down the road and anticipate problems?
Right, and this is a shift, right? This is not the traditional thinking that when we were in school we were being taught. In the same way that I think that all people think the best salespeople need to be extroverts, but that's not the case, right? You need a blend
not
of both.
Yeah, exactly. There's some very interesting research. There's this whole myth out there that affects salespeople are extroverted, strong extroverts. And again, if you look at the evidence, if you look at the data, it is, you know, it's just not flatly, unequivocally not true. But it doesn't mean the strong introverts are better. The best, most effective persuaders and sellers are what social scientists call ambiverts. Not a widely used term, although it's been around for almost 100 years. Mm-hmm. And these are people who are somewhat introverted and somewhat extroverted.
Right.
They're not strongly one way or another. And what they are, if you think about it in, you know, they're ambidextrous. That is, you know, they can go left, they can go right. They know when to shut up, they know when to speak up. They know when to push, they know when to hold back. And I actually think that quality, just in saying it out loud, is very much... do you think the best improv artists are ambiverts?
Totally. This is the thing that's amazing, right?
I truly never thought of that until literally this conversation. Like right now, in real time, I never thought about that.
Yep, because so many of the people who come in, I remember this, I worked with Steve Carell. At that point, if you had met Steve Carell, you would have been like, that wallflower. You know, I mean, he was sort of shy in person, and he kind of kept to himself. Then he'd go on stage and explode. So he really sort of, and this is also, to me, ties into Danny Kahneman stuff, right? The sort of system one, system two part of the brain, the idea of working in a dynamic. And all, because we've done some work with behavioral scientists actually just recently. And what they're interested in when they look at our stuff is we have practices in behaviors around making different choices, around give and take, around all these things that they're writing about as a matter psychology, economics, and all that stuff. So it's kind of rich territory.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I also want to congratulate you for being maybe the first person to say the name Steve Carell and Danny Kahneman in adjoining sentences.
Yeah, like in a 30-second period.
Yeah, that's. I wish Guinness was on the line right now.
I know, me too. I'm proud of myself. Thank you for pointing that out. This is going to be this is the best part of the podcast ever. Okay, So here's another, this is, I love like stupid, weird, fun tidbits that then I talk about with everyone. And anyone who knows me is, you know, knows how annoying that is. But I learned something from your book. And I think many people completely,
I'm glad.
Yeah, people completely misunderstand the source of the term elevator pitch. Right?
Interesting. Okay.
Because I, you know, when I first, and I was doing elevator pitches, and I always assumed the elevator pitch is the time in which you have to get from one floor to another.
Yes. Now you know that that's not the case.
That's false.
I want to hear you tell the story.
Well, so what I know of the story, and
if you've been dining out on my hard edge research, I want to hear this.
Well, and I don't remember the names, but essentially the elevator pitch was a guy pitching elevators.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so, and this is, you know, before elevators. So are we talking like turn of the century?
Yeah. Right, exactly. That's what it was. And so, yeah. I mean, it ended up morphing into something more generic. It has a peculiar story. And he ended up doing this you got to realize, like at the time, say 130 years ago, how freaking weird elevators were.
Right.
Like, what? You can move up and, like, there weren't that many buildings of any height. And so the idea, and one reason there weren't, is because you had to trudge up all the stairs. And the idea was that you could, like, wait, it's like driverless cars seem to us today.
Yeah.
What? Driverless cars? How can that possibly be? Mm-hmm. What? You can go up floors without stairs? This is crazy talk. And he did this demo where he did it in the hopes that the participant in the elevator wouldn't die. And you know, he did it, and... You know, this is, you know, the time it's the, you know, the end of the 19th century. So in America, there is kind of P.T. Barnum kind of showmanship, circusy vibe going through the country. And so they were, it was part of that. And so elevator pitch had its origin by pitching the preposterous idea of elevators.
Right. And you talk about pitches, and I had a playwriting teacher who told me that if you couldn't describe your play in one sentence, then you don't have a play.
Bless him or her.
Yeah, it's her. She was great. And you take that notion a bit farther when you talk about like a one word pitch.
Yes. This is an idea comes from an ad man, famous advertising agent, executive named Morris Sacher. British guy, and he says that you know, there's so much noise out there today, mm-hmm. that every brand has to stand for one word. That is, you have to have what he calls one word equity, so that when people say the word, they think of you. When people think of you, they say the word, and you want to own basically that one word. And so, if you think of, you know, in America especially, you say the word search. Okay, who do you think of? Google.
Yeah.
All right. But I actually think that Second City has one word equity in improv.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
I really do.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you say Second City, people are going to say improv. Mm-hmm. And I actually think a huge number of people, if you say improv, they'll say Second City.
Right. And they don't even know necessarily what we do, you know, in terms of using improvisation to write scripted, you know, content. And it actually kind of doesn't matter. This is something that I worked in the box office, and I was always getting frustrated because people would call to be like, I want to see Carrot Top. And I'm like, Carrot Top's not here. it's something very different. But you sell them the ticket and they have the great experience. I mean, I imagine this is the situation with Kleenex and tissue, right? I mean, we say Kleenex, we mean tissue. Kleenex is a brand.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. That's you've treaded into dangerous territory because not only did I go to Northwestern, but I was a linguistics major. And so what the phenomenon you're describing there is something that is known both in linguistics and in the legal profession as genericide.
Nice.
Where a term becomes a term that's a protected trademark becomes so used that it becomes generic. And therefore difficult, and therefore you can't protect it because the use has developed in a way that makes it a generic use. Nobody says, "Oh, I need it. I have to sneeze. Does anyone have a tissue?"
Right.
Maybe British people say that, but but everyone says, you know. So Kleenex has been genericized.
Yep.
Similar.
Yeah. Hey, what is a Pixar pitch? You talk about that.
Oh man. This is really interesting. There's a story editor there who. And actually, it's interesting. In the course, since this book has been out on other emails saying, "Oh no, this is an idea that has multiple parents," it seems. But there was, I heard about it from a story editor at Pixar, who says that every Pixar movie has the same basic narrative structure, and that you can actually reduce that structure to six very simple sentences. And they go like this: once upon a time, bada, bada, bada. Every day, bada, bada, bada. One day, bada, bada, bada. Because of that, ba, ba, ba. Because of that, ba, ba, ba. Until finally, ba, ba, ba. And what's kind of scary about that is that, yeah, I mean, you can reduce every Pixar movie to that. But the other thing is, it's actually a really, really good way to pitch an idea, a really good way to pitch a business, you know, sort of business, sort of you're pitching for raising capital. And I think that it is a discipline that force, like the one word thing, like your playwriting teacher, that forces you to say, okay, what is this really about?
Right. I always think every marketing professional should read Joseph Campbell.
Certainly. Yeah, and his is even more. I mean, I like Joseph Campbell, and actually, as it happens, Kelly, I wrote about Joseph Campbell and this idea, a little bit about the hero's journey and some of the dimensions of it in another book that I did years ago called A Whole New Mind.
Yep.
But I actually think Joseph Campbell, that hero's journey has, 14 steps?
Yeah, there's a lot more.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And this one is, in some ways, even tighter. And when I go and talk to companies and about some of the ideas in this particular book, we sometimes will do that exercise, our pitch exercise, where we say, okay, what I want you to do is, you know, what are you working on right now? I want you to pitch it to a funder. I want you to pitch it to your boss, but I want you to use this format. Here it is. Go. And I think what I find interesting is how quickly people take to it.
Yep.
That is, there's a sort of natural affinity with that. That it, at some level, it is, there's this kind of paradoxical thing going on, because you see in creativity in many cases, basically saying, here, I'm going to impose these very rigid constraints, and the consequence of that is that it liberates their creativity. That is, constraints liberate in this particular case.
Yep.
And I think it suggests that, you know. I mean, human beings, we see the world as a series of episodes, not as a series of logical propositions.
Yep.
And we also, I think there's something native biological about even like the three-act structure of certain kinds of dramas. The hero's journey.
Yep.
Even the Pixar pitch. There's an arc. There's a that is not kind of confected or invented by human beings, but is actually kind of emerges from being human.
Yeah, there's math and rhythm too. And my wife, who is a comedy professor, she runs the only BA in comedy writing performance and writing in the country at Columbia College. We were co-lecturing at Stanford to a graduate school business class, and she was teaching them how to write a joke. And one of the basic, and they were like, we can't do it. She's like, no, there's just some real easy math. Take a item in the news, and we pulled up like a Facebook feed, any item in the news, lay out what that item is, and then say in other news, and find something incongruous to match to it. And everyone did it. And while not all the jokes were good or great, some of them actually were, they all sounded like jokes.
I love that. I need to take this course.
Oh yeah. No, she's a fellow Wildcat. You guys graduated the same year.
Yeah. Man, I should have paid more attention to the serious theater people that your wife was rather than like the jokesters.
I know.
Yeah, no, I think you make a very good point, a deeper point there, which is that, you know, there are a lot of people out there who say, oh, I'm not creative, I'm not funny, blah, 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 blah. And I just think that's nonsense. I think that being able to generate things, being able to look at situations in novel, fresh, zany ways is part of what it is to be human. I just think a lot of people feel like they're not given kind of guide rails, and they're not given permission to do it.
Well,
but
yeah.
Once you do that, I think people can do great things.
Well, there's a lot of people who've invested a lot of time and energy in making money for themselves who want to be considered magic.
Right.
That's exactly. That's one problem. And I think a lot of our sort of educational, you know, constructs also, you know, don't design a lot of space there's a lot of knowledge exchange, but there's not a lot of space for, you know, intuition. I was reading this. There was an article in The Economist the other day, and this really a teacher who has his class on their feet all the time. He said, "I don't teach physics. I teach my students how to learn physics." And I just love that.
I love that.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's so smart. Such a better way to go.
Amen.
All right. So let's a whole new mind is basically how I got introduced to you. And I turned 50 this year. So there was a particular resonance for me when you wrote, as individuals age, they place greater emphasis in their own lives on qualities that they might have neglected in the rush to build careers and raise families. Purpose, intrinsic motivation, and meaning. And you say later, meaning is the new money. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, you have to have money in order, you know. I don't want to say that it's a replacement, but the people have to be able to survive, obviously. But if you look at, you know, the great irony here is that this book was about kind of the rise of right brain thinking. I am the most resolutely left brain person you've ever met. I'm like, you know, scientific, mathematical, you know, very linear in the way that I think about things. Mm-hmm. But I think if you look at the evidence really clear, there's a very famous study called the Grant Study, started 75 years ago or so, that tracked about 600 men who happened to be at Harvard through the course of their lives. And they get surveyed and blood tested and brain scanned. When those things came out, almost every year that they were alive, there's something like 60 of them still alive. And essentially what they found was that, you know, what's the secret to happiness? And they found it.
Yeah.
And it basically was close relationships, having a sense of meaning in your life. That's what it was. And it did, and all these things, the pursuit of fame, of money, of riches, of da-da-da-da. It, you know, sometimes people who are rich are happy. Sometimes they're not. But it's essentially an irrelevant variable. What really makes people satisfied, especially in the second half of their life, especially in the second half of their life when they're confronting their mortality, is why am I here and who do I care about and who cares about me? And that's it.
Yep. And look, you and I both probably know a lot of people with a lot of money. I mean, I grew up in Kenilworth, you know, and while we were probably the, you know, poor people in Kenilworth, it was still Kenilworth.
Right.
And the ratio of happiness to money, it didn't even connect. I've known very happy people who had money, but mostly sad people or unhappy people, and that goes across the spectrum. But indeed, I mean, you know, if the science is showing it, sort of my sort of personal evidence that I've seen around are the people who have those kinds of, you know, relationships and passion and curiosity, people who are lifelong learners. And again, these are the great thing about the work that I've been involved with at Second City is all these improv philosophies speak to just that. They speak to getting out of your own way, to paying attention and listening deeply, actively to others, and then saying yes and to experiences, not saying, you know, no, giving things a shot. And rarely have I, you know, at the end of an experience said, you know, I wish I didn't do that. There's always, even if it goes terribly awry, that's the best story. Our best stories are when things go awry.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
But so, I do think that it is, I mean, not to you know, suggest that I've completely drunk the Kool-Aid, but I really do think you can look at the lessons of improv, to go sort of hyper intellectual on you, kind of the theology mm-hmm. of improv. And it is, like other kinds of theologies, a guide to life.
Yeah.
And I say that not only because I'm on your podcast, Kelly, but I've said it to civilians. No, but I mean that to civilians too. Yep. When you think about this, I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example of just my own, how much this has changed the way I approach things. It's not like a monumental example, but I'm on the board of a nonprofit, and the nonprofit is involved in a dispute. Without going into great detail about that,
okay.
With another nonprofit, and basically. Sort of a little bit of a dispute. And there was some communication recently. And I said to this group, we have to listen for an offer here. Mm-hmm. We have to listen for offer. And there's an offer here, guys.
Yep.
Right? We got to get away from this idea that we're going to try to battle them. Like, look at this again. and tell me, this, there's an offer here. It doesn't say, I offer you X, Y, or Z, but read it again and think about it as if you're looking, as if you're trying to hear an offer.
Yep.
And that was huge.
Yep. Every obstacle
is a gift. There's no way pre-improv, knowing a little bit about improv, there's no way I would have had that approach. I would have been, as someone who actually went to law school, I would have been, let's crush them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a whole different orientation,
right.
And it tends to, you know, it's I've talked about this before on the podcast, but so many people with social anxiety end up studying improvisation, and that right. I mean, and my initial thought was that that's insane until you dig into it a little bit, and you're like, oh no, I mean, this allows people to be very mindful with other people in social situations. And for those of my friends who suffer from this and have gone on, they've been like, that's, you know, when I'm improvising is the place I don't feel anxious. It's the one place I don't, because it forces me to not live in the past, not live in the future, only live in the present, which is the only way you could be really look at that document and say, there's an offer.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I, you know, I really do. I think that this, you know, obviously the idea of saying yes, and that's, you know, thanks to you guys, that's very well known now. You know, hearing offers, trying to listen. I think what's so, as I've studied this kind of stuff, I think what's so interesting is that you think about our schools. You mentioned that teacher there, like, we, you know, we teach kids how to read, we teach kids how to write,
mm-hmm.
but we just assume that everybody's how to listen.
Yeah.
And they don't.
No, and they don't listen actively. They don't listen to the whole person. And look, it's not their fault, because it's not taught and it's not
exactly
emphasized.
Exactly. It's like, you know, if you look at you know, the fact that we have these, I mean, it's an incredible thing. We have eyes and we have ears, and they allow us to process information from the external world. But the fact that I have eyes doesn't mean that I can see. But if you have training as an artist, as visual artist, or an art historian, or something like that, you actually see the world differently. Yeah. And I think that what we don't do is we don't train people's ears enough, no one has ever taught anybody except if you take improv,
yeah,
how to listen.
Well, you know, we have a bias against hearing, and I forget where I was listening to this, but it was a wonderful interview with a guy who had a severe learning disability, and he was a scholar now, and he the only way he could read the books was to hear the books, and he had professors who were like, that's not the same thing, and if you step back from that in a moment, and you're like, what is the difference? He, instead of using his eyes, he used his ears,
yeah,
to get the same material. But I know I've heard people be like, ah, they just listen to the books. That's not reading it. Like it's a lesser.
Yeah. As someone who writes books that are made into audiobooks, you know, as long as they buy it rather than borrow it, I'm fine.
Yep, exactly. We are coming to the end of our podcast, and although you've actually already shared, you know, some yes and stuff with me, I did ask you to consider a story from your life and work or whatever where maybe you could have said no, maybe you did say no, or you said yes and. Is there a moment in your life that you see as relevant to that concept?
Well, I tell you, the first thing that I thought of was an experience I had literally last week. It's not like a transformative life experience.
That's okay.
But it might have been the kind of thing that I wouldn't have done pre-improv training.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to be in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, and I was at this. Just found myself, weird story or whatever. I found myself at this. It's Ramadan, and I found myself at this dinner, an iftar dinner to break the fast. And they're, you know, the servers are going around and saying da 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 da, and they're asking me, because I'm obviously not from. I'm basically a white guy from Ohio.
Yep.
And the server says, "Oh, would you like some of this? What is it? It's camel."
Hmm.
And I said, yes, and could you tell me what I should put on it? So, not a life transformation, but it's the kind of thing where in that moment, I didn't know, but I would like some chicken.
Right.
You know, it was yes, and what, you know, how do I eat it? So I think that that's my most recent yes and story.
All right, and was the, real quickly though, like, was it a chimichurri sauce? What did you? Would you accompany this
you
thing?
You know what? He said, actually, it really doesn't need much because it was sort of cooked in some, it sort of seemed to be
a spice,
brined or something like that and cooked. And, you know, I ate it and, I mean, it's going to sound like I'm making a joke, but I'm really not. I mean, it tasted like chicken. I mean, it really did. It tasted like right. dark peat chicken. I'm not kidding.
No, I get you.
Really
I believe you.
All my right. kids are like, you know, I said, I eat camel. First of all, they're disgusted with their father.
Yes.
And so that's a unique experience. And then second, they're like, what did it taste like? And I was like, it tasted like chicken.
Oh, and they gave you like the brush off and left the room.
Yeah. Something else I'm used to.
Yeah. All right. And you had one more. You had a second Yes And story you were leading up to.
The other one is I have had several instances where in my life where I had a chance to a little bit out of the blue to go far away to Botswana at one point, to India at one point, mm-hmm. To Japan at one point for extended periods of time, and despite some nervousness, I said yes. And to, you know, and to all of those. And I think that ethic is great. And I really do think it's like, you know, the and part sometimes gets overlooked.
Sure.
That is, it's easy to get up the gumption, not easy, but people can get up the gumption to say yes
right.
to something.
Right.
But I think it's the and that really makes you think. Because it's sort of, so yes, and what's the best way to go about this? Yes. And I'm going to keep a journal so I can remember everything. It's really the and part that I think is transformative.
You nailed it.
It's like the sauce for the camel meat, basically.
It is the salt for the camel. Can we trademark that? This is the book.
Yeah.
This is the book that you co-write.
Oh, there you go. This is your elevator pitch. Second City. It's the sauce and, you know, it's the sauce for the camel meat. I'm not sure it's going to really work that well.
I don't know. I think we should, yeah, let's kick it around more.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yes. And let's bring in other people. See, now I'm going to say yes and the rest of the day.
And people are going to be real annoyed with you.
Yeah. And so my kids are going to, you know, one of the kids is going to say, you know, Dad, can I, you know, my 13-year-old, Dad, can I borrow the bourbon and the chainsaw? Yes, and make sure that you get back in, you know.
Well, this is the thing that trips me up when I go and do all the corporate work I do is with, you know, there's always people like, I can't say yes and everything. And we're like, well, we're only talking about like the first 5 minutes in a creativity conversation. We're not talking about when your kid wants to borrow the car keys and they don't have a driver's
right.
license. No
right,
is fine.
Exactly.
No is appropriate. Dan yeah, Pink, yeah. Thanks for joining us on Getting to Yes And.
My pleasure. It was a really fun conversation. Thanks for having me, Kelly.
You can find all things Dan Pink at danpink.com. Buy his books. Book him to speak. We will see you next week with an all-new podcast. Well, I've been working in a corner.